Blog Talk Radio.
It's time. Politics on the Navajo Nation, brought to you by Cal Nez Design, and hosted by Cal Nez himself.
Hey, folks, you know this is Cal Nez. You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. This evening, we have a guest, Mr. Robert Carr, calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Yat ehe shaman sa aren hi shi
ta hu yi zi. Yat ehe shi shi Mr. Cal Nez. Nice to hear your voice again. I don't like how she no cost an Navajo Nation. She came with she. He called a shan to the nation. He called in the Albuquerque, New Mexico, da wa jenide ade ea, beste hashna ade di de ea, e si go no shabi in the tunne, in ba ha jenek tu lisa in Arizona, ade e si ya nasha, ade ea, rusia ho a, ado che hende beste di kel. Ata ne, chfiniki ea tu la tabi in ga da we, chfin, ado di de ea, tekish di de da wa jenek di ko de, Navajo Nation Western Agency Day, South Tumade, Ade, Ishi, Tadishki, Minshkani, Ade, Akosha, Chikay, Yohin, Nafa, Abahal, Ade, Ado, Edi, Koda, Vashishin, Edi, Kirsan, Edi, Dashija, Dashishin, Edi, Bekashi, Kota, Vajanili, Tash, Spring, Lore, Later, Benahas, Ade, Akoya, Edo, Yu, Adashin, Adishin, Edahoda.
Aha, well, that sounds good, Oshananta. Well, we're sitting here talking about basketball. First of all, introduce that legend Hall of Fame.
Okay, once again, this is Mr. Robert Carr. This certain particular once-in-a-lifetime event that was put together is called the Navajo Nation Legendary Sports Hall of Fame within the Navajo Nation. I was contacted by the Southwest Sports Foundation. There was a big basketball tournament that was coming upon the Navajo Nation. And I was contacted, and they said that we were selected by your peers, other basketball players, sports fans across the Navajo Nation for legendary basketball players back from the 70s. That's about 30, 40 years ago. So they told me that I was selected, one of the 13 ever selected, with 12 other big friends of mine that I competed with throughout the years. So at this point in time, this fortunate players, some of them are still playing, and some of them have are not here anymore with us. But first of all, I would like to name off those 12 legendary basketball players from the 70s on up. First is my good old friend, Willard Sonny Jimmy. He played with the Flagstaff Redskins. Then his brother, Ray Sonny Jimmy, with the Flagstaff Redskins. The third one is a coach from Kent, Arizona, Monument Valley High School, who happens to be a good friend of mine, who I competed against for many years, is Mr. Robert Nash. Coach Nash, he is called. He used to play with the King Tawahus back in the 70s. And then there was the late, my good old friend, we used to call him AC, Mr. Alvin Clark, who played with other one is the late Fred Singer with the Kiantawabu. And then we have two brothers from Covington, Arizona, which is Sonny and Leonard Brown. Those two brothers were very, very unstoppable, and they played with the Covington Red. And then there is Terry J. Yazzie from Ganado, Arizona, who happens to be still playing in the basketball circuit up today. And he is nearly 60 years old, I believe. He's probably 59 or 60 years old. Right after my buddy Harry J. Yazzie is Mike Begay. He played with the Biltron Bucks. Him and his brother by the name of Craig Begay. Those guys were one of a kind back in the day during the early 70s. Then we have from Luke, Arizona, is Mr. Frank Kelly. He could shoot your lights out. At those days, there was no three-pointers, Kelly. So these guys were hitting about 10, 15 three-pointers a game. Then we have Mr. Donald Sunsi, who is currently residing in Texas, I believe, the last time I've talked with him. He played with Robert Nash from the Kiantawabus. This guy, the next guy that I am going to be calling him, is Sunsi Brown from Chile, Arizona. This guy was unstoppable back in the 1970s and 80s. And to name off all these, and I played with the Flagstaff Maka, some guys from Hernal, Dallas, Randy Watamahamiji from Peach Springs, some other guys from Zoom guys. From Zuni, New Mexico. And so we had a camaraderie with all these other guys. And so far in this year, 2013 and 14, I believe it's only myself and Will Cittagini and Harry J. Yazzie that are still playing. But in them days, there was no three-pointers. And the thing about it is that these guys used to make about 40, 50 points because they used to be shooting from way beyond the three-point line, counted as 2 points. Yeah. So the last time that we all met together was during the championship team at a big tournament that was held on the MO Nation. Robert Nash was there, and then Sonny Brown was there, Leonard Brown was there, Mike Begay was there. Sunsi Brown was there, and we all got our awards there at the halftime championship game.
Is this the high school league, or is this Red Ball?
It's a Red Ball open basketball tournament they had on the Navajo Nation.
Oh, I see. Has there been any others besides this group?
There has never, ever. I know that because I've been asking around. It's the very first one that was ever made, the 13 selected. So right now, I am very, very fortunate that I got to play with all these guys, and there was a lot of memories. We all talked about each other, how one of them fell down, or how one of them fouled a game 35 years ago, 40 years ago. We'd say, he's the one that pushed me, he's the one that fouled out. We always had respect for each other.
Yeah.
And these are the 12 other elite basketball players that I know that I got to know through the last 30, 40 years of my life. And it's such a great feeling that these guys left a trail for other young basketball players today.
Hey, Rob, just real quickly, tell me about that one basketball player that says that he still does dunks and all of that. That's somebody who we need to bring out real quickly.
Yes, this guy, he is one of the very few. He's a Native American. His name is Kenny Dobbins. Lives down in Phoenix area. He is one of the top three world's best slam dunkers. We had invited him to come to our basketball tournament in Winslow, Arizona on the 18th and 19th of April. So he will be doing a halftime show and a demonstration. Earlier I spoke with my brother Kel in regards to this, is that a lot of young Native kids, when you ask them, who is your favorite basketball player? Who is your idol? Who is your role model? Right away, they say, I want to be like Michael Jordan, or I want to be like Kobe, I want to be like LeBron James. But hereupon, the Navajo Nation and the Native community, we have our own legendary basketball players as role models for a lot of these young kids can look up to. So So it's just a wonderful feeling to give back to young kids and the community.
Exactly, and that's something that we all should be very proud of. I just want to throw another question. What do you think about, you know, because there's a lot of very good ball players, and then unfortunately a lot of them don't go into the next level, either Division I, II, or III, or even professional basketball, even though I think that the talent is there. But there's a lot of red ball. I mean, there's a lot of private tournaments that are taking place. I was just sitting here toying with the idea, and I explained this to you earlier. We used to put a basketball tournament together here. And I wonder if people would be interested if we had, like, what I call the Inner Mountain or the Rocky Mountain area, all Indian basketball tournament, and have maybe the states, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Colorado, Nevada, all the way up in South Dakota, have them produce a state, and then we narrow it down, and we have a tournament possibly here in Salt Lake City, Utah, for all the top basketball teams from each of the states. We have our own Final Four, and then eventually the national or the western states. How much of a possibility do you think that might be?
Well, it could be done, because right now I'm still thinking that what we could do is contact these other legendary basketball players, see what they think, and because they have a lot of connections and they have their kids that are playing high school, they have their kids playing all different kind of basketball tournaments, and they even have grandkids. I go to different basketball tournaments up in South Dakota, then there's Fort Hall, Idaho, and over here at the Nationals in Albuquerque, down in Phoenix and Parker, and Lone Pine Independent, up in Salt Lake, Denver area and Mississippi area. These junior college basketball players, I mean, once they do hear about that, and then it's going to be one of a kind, and then we could build on that, and it could be an annual event to where we will showcase our own Native American basketball players. And right now, the Native American Basketball Invitational, which is called the NABI, is usually for high school basketball players down in Phoenix every July. But the thing about it is that's where it is. There's only the high school. But what about other junior college basketball players are not being noticed? But if we have a major basketball tournament where a regionals will happen first, and then coming down to the Sweet 16, then they come to the Final 8, and then the Final 4, who will come down as the best Native American basketball team in the country? Because there is a lot of talent, Native talent out there, a lot of res ball out there, res ball basketball players, and they need to be given this chance and this opportunity to be noticed.
One last question, Robert. I just wanted to know, is there such a thing as the best basketball player, or can we even go that far?
Well, yes and no at the same time, because there are different basketball players from different years and different times. Best all-around basketball player that I've known and I've played against for many years become my good old buddy Willard Sinigini from Tucson City, Arizona. He played with the Flagstaff Redskins for many years. He is probably one of the best, I would say, all-around basketball players throughout the last 40, 50 years that I've seen.
Yeah, well, that sounds good. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That was Mr. Robert Carr, and I will keep posting on Facebook. Thank you. Go ahead, Lon.
All right, thank you, brother, and good night, everybody out there on the Indian country.
You're listening to Navajo Digital Radio, politics on the Navajo Nation. The radio show that's raising standards of Navajo intellect, a real paradigm shift, no double talk, no fool.
Hey,
Kohasi, so you are listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. Askohasi, so are not a CEO, Kizigi, Shahada, non Hiddish Nido, Lest Anosko. We got several things on the plate. So, welcome. The telephone number here is 347-989-0048. So this evening we have got, let me give you some updates, okay? I have tried to contact the Office of Attorney General, Mr. Harrison Soce, Dana Barbaroff, and of course, I haven't heard back from them. I only got one call. They said they'll be back in touch with me. I wanted to talk about the Office of the Special Prosecutor and what exactly their role is and how the contract works and what it specifically says in the codes as far as their particular role when they're investigating and all of that. There's so that one is still up in the air, and we probably are going to get some updates. It sounds to me like Marty Shabala has all sorts of information on that, so maybe we can she can enlighten us a bit about that as well. And she is scheduled to be here with us. Actually, she is on the line. So, and the other one is I have tried to also engage the Office of Special not the Special Prosecutor, but I already talked about that. The other one is the Navajo Nation Finances. So at any given moment, we're supposed to also get a call from Mr. Lorenzo Bates, who is the pro temp speaker for the Navajo Nation Council. But he is also going to be with us this evening as the chair of the Budget and Finance Standing Committee for the Navajo Nation Council. So that should give us a lot of insight on it. And while we're waiting for these calls, I believe we have hello, can you hear me? 3221. Are you on the air?
Yes, this is Colleen.
Hi. Oh, yate. So while we're waiting, I wanted to get an update from Dinette Care. So, Colleen, go ahead. Introduce yourself and what you want to announce.
So, yate, she'e Colleen Cooley and she'e kia ani na shuon look at Dinette Bashishin, toi he glini e de she'e and isasana de shanella. Shant toi de e yisina sha. Di Dinette Care will yehigi Banashnish. We're hosting a community awareness rally this coming Saturday, April 19th, in Shiprock, at the Shiprock Park. I wanted to invite everybody out there. If anybody can make it to this rally, we're having this rally for the people, the Navajo people, or anybody is invited. Everybody's welcome. We're going to be talking about the draft environmental impact statement, which just was released on March 28th. This is regarding the Four Corners Power Plant and Navajo Mine. So it's an 850-page or up to, I think, 1,500 pages, the booklet, the EIS that came out. So it's a lot of information in there for an average person to read through, and the Office of Surface Mining is only giving the public 60 days to comment and read through it. They assess the impacts, environmental impacts such as water quality, air quality, climate change, vegetation, all those kind of things, because Navajo Mine and Four Corners Power Plant, their lease is ending in 2016. So in order to renew their lease, they need to do this assessment. Anyways, what we're doing is talking about some of the results, what's in it, what's missing, also talking about including a health impact study, and just providing information to the people, because the Office of Surface Mining is only visiting 4 Navajo communities for their public meetings as well. So they're not really outreaching to most of the people on the Navajo Nation and giving this information out. And the current comment period ends on May 27th. So that's pretty almost a month away already, and we're trying to ask also for an extension for the people to have enough time to look at the EIS and to comment on it as well. So anyways, if anybody is interested, the rally is happening April 19th again at the Shiprock Park from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And if you want to contact me for more information, the email address is DineCare, so Dine, D-I-N-E, Care, C-A-R-E, 88, @gmail.com. Or I can give my phone number as well, 928-637-3221. The number again is 928-637-3221. So that's your hat. Thank you.
There you have it. Whoever is interested, you're welcome to give them a buzz and that care. And appreciate their announcement and their participation. And if you have on I hope you're having a wonderful evening. And this is the hump day for all of us that are out there working and such like that. And while we're waiting for Mr. Lorenzo Bates to give us a call, I would like to bring on our featured guest, one of our featured guests, and she comes and calls every week, and I really appreciate her support and the knowledge that she puts on the Navajo on her website. It's very informative, and she links it to the Politics on the Navajo Nation group page, and I'd like to welcome Marley Shabala. Yate Marley.
Oh, yate A, Calnez, and this is Marley Shabala. And I'm calling in from Window Rock, Arizona. And I thought it was the capital of the Navajo Nation, but somebody put in that it was unofficially the Navajo Nation capital. But anyway.
I didn't know that. That's a new insight. So what is the official Navajo Nation capital then?
You know, actually, I think it should be Canyon de Chelly, from what stories I've heard. And this is from our Navajo elders who say that that's where our government, our real government, met. And they consisted of 12 chiefs of peace and 12 chiefs for wartime. And they weren't elected like we have them now, which is based on, you know, the Western society of popularity votes. You know, whoever can give us the most promises, and then we don't care to follow up on them, I guess. But, you know, back then, it was based on knowledge and how much how they were actually, I guess, really not Ani, medicine people. So they knew the prayers and the ceremonies and knew how to really take care of the people and themselves, you know. And they thought not just about the five-fingered ones, but about all of life, the four-fingered, the ones that crawl, the ones that live in the water, the ones that, the winged ones, all of life on Mother Earth and between Father Sky and even Father Sun. I mean, it was all of life, and it wasn't just this area of the world. It was Mother Earth. You know, that's how we say our prayers. We never say, oh, you know, Creator, just bless the Navajo Nation, you know, which you hear President Obama and other, you know, presidents or, you know, other leaders say, you know, God bless America instead of, you know, Mother Earth. And so, you know, I was listening to Colleen talking about the environmental impact statement, and I don't know how many of our listeners have read an environmental impact statement, but it's full of bureaucratic terms, you know, and you can really get lost in it, and it's several pages, and it would be good if they, and this has been a request I've heard from Navajo people during my time that I was here on the reservation covering the Navajo Nation about 28 years, and there's always a request to have it translated into Navajo, you know, to have them educated about it. What does it really mean? And I always thought about when the government and these oil and gas companies first came to us out in the eastern Navajo area. They wanted to do the oil and gas exploration out around Shiprock, and we basically asked them environmental impact statement questions. And those questions were concerning Mother Earth and how she is, you know, treated and any of the life that is out there. Excuse me, I'm buzzing. It's not a, well, it's a fire alarm, but there's no fire. I think somebody's cooking and the fire alarm went off. Anyway, I also wanted to talk about the special prosecutors. And people are very concerned about what they've heard concerning the special prosecutors and what they are supposed to be doing or not supposed to be doing, who's paying them, who's their bosses. And all those questions were debated at great length by the Navajo Nation Council in 1989 when they were trying to figure out a way to place then Chairman Peter McDonald on administrative leave because there was a federal there were federal hearings that were held in Washington D.C. and they found out that that there were several serious federal charges that were going to be filed against Mr. McDonald, and then they were filed. And I think that's the difference between what happened with the council placing former President Joe Shirley on administrative leave. There were no charges filed against President Joe Shirley. And the council, though, decided that they would go ahead and put him on administrative leave. And it was, of course, overturned by the courts because there were no charges filed against him. But that's what initiated the special prosecutors for this bout of investigations. And the first investigations that were requested were of the BCDS, which was that company up in Shiprock, New Mexico, and also of OnSet, the internet company, because at that time they were closely connected to President Shirley and very much supported by him. And the way that started was there was a request from the council to actually, they presented evidence to the Attorney General at that time, who was Louis DiNizzi. And that's the process under the special prosecutor law. Evidence is presented to the Attorney General. The Attorney General will review it. And the Attorney General is given a certain amount of time to do the review and come out with a decision as to whether or not the special prosecutor is needed. And once that decision is made, then that request is handed over once the decision is made, then the Attorney General will tell the court, the judicial branch, that a special prosecutor is warranted. And so special prosecutor just doesn't pop up and say, you know, I'm going to start investigating. Or, you know, no one can just go over and say, we want you to investigate this, and they start investigating. It's a serious review of evidence. And then once the Attorney General hands it over to the court, it's no longer, he has nothing to do with it. So even if you had asked Attorney General, or if the Attorney General Harrison Soce had come on the show, he wouldn't have been able to answer any questions about the current investigation and prosecution, because that is something that's under the court. And once you get into any kind of legalities, judges are not going to talk about their cases. You can read what is filed by the prosecutors and any kind of response that's being made, but other than that, no one is going to comment, because they've always told me they're not going to make any kind of legal arguments in the public. It could damage their case, is what I'm always told. And so, you know, they're more than willing to share their court documents with me, but that's about it. And the
Well, here's the thing, Marlene. You know, even the angle that, I mean, I specifically said to them, okay, I understand that there's some legal issues that we really can't discuss. And I'm really not interested in that. I just want to understand the actual contractual arrangement between the Navajo Nation and the special prosecutor. Here's my take on this thing. Okay, I'm not trying to dispute the fact that there has been any alleged wrongdoing or, you know, whatever the case is. But in the business world, when I get hired by a company, let's say I hire Marty Shabala to represent me, and you have a case. I mean, you know, I want you to prosecute somebody else. Well, here's the thing. If I hire you, I would expect for you to act on my behalf to be able to sue or prosecute somebody. Now, so I'm your boss. I'm the one that's going to pay you. I am the one that's going to be, you're going to be defending me. But if you ever turn around, it's most unheard of for you as a company to turn around and to begin suing me. But I can't, you know, if that happens, I would immediately cancel my contract with you and fire you and any type of things that you're going to throw back at me, because I initially, you know, initiated this. Now, here's the angle that example that I just showed, the Navajo Nation Council originally contacted, or, you know, they said, yes, we need a special prosecutor. So, but instead, that's where originally they were going to go after the executive office. But I'm curious, all of a sudden now, the here and now is that now the special prosecutor was most likely, I mean, it's just on the front burner right now, is that the council delegates who are listed in those charges, they're the one that's being investigated. So initially, they were the client. I mean, they were the one that, and they hired the special prosecutor. But how did it happen that now that same special prosecutor is now prosecuting the very company or the very organization or the executive or the legislative branch that hired them? And so, therefore, who is the special prosecutor working under? Who do they answer to? That's all I wanted to get clarified. I still I understand that there's codes on the there's in, on the Navajo Nation codes. There's reference to the special prosecutor's role, and that's that. So, do you know anything? You know what I'm saying, Marley?
Oh yeah, I understand what you're talking about. Okay, okay, the council at the time that they presented their request to the Attorney General, President Joe Shirley was leading a very successful initiative to reduce the Council of 88. And so many people saw this as retaliation by the council against President Shirley. And so anyone can bring evidence to the Attorney General. And that's what's happened with the discretionary funds.
Didn't the executive branch also have a discretionary fund as well?
Yes. See, that's it. I did the stories on the discretionary fund. And the financial records that I received was about the discretionary fund. And there was actually discretionary funds out at the chapter level. It's throughout the tribal government. And people don't, when they think of the tribal government, sometimes they think we only focus in on the council and the president. But we don't understand that there are three branches. The branch, which is the court, the legislative branch, which is where you have the council, and then the executive branch, which is the president and all the... And so when they first, the evidence that came to the Attorney General, yes, it came from the council, because there was an audit that was done. And the Auditor General was under the legislative branch. Then when this issue came up about the discretionary fund and the story that I had written, and I had gone to President Shirley and asked if I could also look at their records and find out what they were doing. And at that time, Chief of Staff Patrick, I talked with Chief of Staff Patrick Sandoval, and I got a bit of information about their process, but they would not release any information about where their funding was going other than to say that it was going to individuals who needed it. But what I finally did get out of them, though, was that some of those funds went to some of their staff people within the office of the president and vice president. And so that was after my series of stories, there was pressure from the public because these funds were for our people that were in the most need, including veterans. And that amount of public pressure brought that to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General used my stories as a basis. And then he was able to call in the financial services and look at what they had. And then he said, there's enough evidence here for the special prosecutor also now to also investigate what's happening with the discretionary funds that go to the council and then also go to the office of the president and the vice president. And so because the special prosecutor, unlike the prosecutor that we have within the Department of Justice, whose boss is actually the Attorney General, the special prosecutor and the way that it was set up by the Navajo Nation Council in 1989 was that special prosecutor had to be independent because that special prosecutor was authorized to investigate the Navajo Nation's highest-ranking officials, the president, the vice president, and the council. And if need be, it would also include the Chief Justice or the Supreme Court. Those individuals who wield a lot of power administratively. And so that's why the special prosecutor, they decided that once the Attorney General made his or her decision and it went into the judicial branch, because of the protection the judicial branch has because it's by itself and could not be controlled, then, you know, it would be safeguarded. And you have to understand the structure of the tribal government, because the Attorney General is a political appointee of the president. And you and the person that you wanted to have come in, who's Dominic Bial, he's the head of the Office of Management and Budget. And
he's under
he
which branch?
Yeah, he's within the executive branch. And he worked side by side with the controller, who is Mark Grant. And during the 1989 political dispute, the controller was a political appointee of the president only. And because of that, the council, in trying to maintain the government, was pretty much blocked from the financial resources of the tribal government. And the controller was taking his orders from then-chairman Peter McDonald. And so people don't realize how much Mr. McDonald had, how much power he actually had. He presided over the council. He was the only one that could sponsor legislation to the council. He decided who was going to talk. He handpicked the standing committees. He handpicked the committee chairs and vice chairs. And his political appointees were not just the division directors. It went down to the deputy directors. It went down into the program directors. He selected the chief of police. I mean, there was this, I mean, it, that when people talk about the 49ers, I mean, they were up against the tribal government, in a sense. But yet they were willing to also look at due process and say, we really need to find an independent way to maintain ourselves as elected officials. And that's how the special prosecutor's office was created. But it still has, the council still has a connection to it because they provide the funding. And that's what happened with the first special prosecutor, Alan Ballerin. When he started investigating the discretionary funds, which was the council, they started making it difficult for him to get his contract money, even though he was working. And the judicial branch was saying, yes, you know, he's making his reports to us. He is doing his work, you know, and he deserves to be paid because he's working. And so that got all mixed up in all of this. And when people say that the tribe is the one that is paying for all of these prosecutions, you're right, they are. But why did they even get started? It's because of allegations of misuse of tribal funds. And why are these allegations of misuse of funds? Because the laws that we have right now regarding our finances are pretty much, they're just a bunch of loopholes in them. I mean, nobody knew until after the Navajo Nation Investment Committee had decided to pull money from each of the trust funds, which included the veterans, the handicapable, the scholarships. And I don't know the other, can't remember off the top of my head what the other trust funds were, to use them to get a loan to construct these casinos. Even the council didn't know, because that the law allows the investment committee to make its decisions on its own. And so you have to ask, you know, I had to, you know, really just repeatedly, you know, tell me who is the best investment committee. And I finally was told, oh, the chairperson is Mark Grant. And when do they meet? Well, you know, we're not sure, you know. So there's no public announcement of when the investment committee meets.
Yeah.
And,
hey,
and
Marty,
I mean.
Hold that thought. Let me, because he's got such very limited time to devote to us. I do want to talk about this even some more, because you know, you've got some valuable information, and so let me put you on hold. And I've got Lorenzo, Honorable Lorenzo Bates, a pro temp speaker, who's going to talk about the budget, and he's on the phone. So we'll carry this conversation on in a bit. Okay. Hold on a second here. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this evening we're going to be talking, you know, again, we're going to be talking about the role of the special prosecutor, and also I wanted to talk about the Navajo Nation budget. Here's my take on this. The here and now, we are in the, you know, year 2014, and we keep hearing about monies that are expended here, there. There's revenues that come in. I know it's a huge, huge discussion all the way across the board. There's, you know, as a general public, we don't know where some of these monies are coming from. It'd be nice to know. So as an informational discussion is why that I have called upon, I actually called Mark Grant, and Mark Grant basically said that he is going to give me a call back when he's available. So I don't know how much more preparation that I need to give that gentleman, and as well as Dominic Bial, for them to talk about information that they should just have right on top of their heads. I only was interested from last year's FY 2013, but you know, so I'm pretty much placed on the back burner. And really, I mean, I preface the whole telephone conversation that it is important that the Navajo general public has got to know about the about our monies. And since we're talking about, you know, some losses of funds and yada yada, whatever that's out there, we know all about that. But what about over here? We have the Navajo Nation budget. You know, it'd be nice to kind of get in general terms where these monies are coming from, where the revenues, and once it's in, obviously, you know, that big piece of the pie is then sliced up amongst all the tribal programs. So that's why I invited Honorable Lorenzo Bates to join us this evening.
Whoa. Oh, yate, Cal. This is the first time I got home when the sun is still up the last 2 weeks. Well, so I'm at home right now. I was headed to another chapter meeting, but they postponed it and until next week. So here I am giving you a call.
We appreciate that.
Well, let me just go into... to the budget, as you described. There's different monies, different pots of monies. There's the general fund money, and then there's external money. And the external and the general fund money is revenue that is generated from within Navajo. Taxes, leases, minerals, oil, gas, coal, anything that is generated within is general fund money. That's what the government operates on. And when I say government, that includes Windorock, chapters, three branches. The government operates on those dollars. And a certain percent of it, as those dollars come in, is put into set asides, land acquisition, perm fund, veterans fund, etc. So after all of those set asides are deducted, then it comes to a net amount. And that net amount, excuse me, for this past year is $175 million. So that's what the government is operating on today, general fund dollars. External monies include grants, awards, IDC monies, and whatever the federal government feels good about giving to the BIA and then us getting a share of that. Those are external dollars. And in depending on how the grants are structured, they got to be primarily for direct services back to the people. But in some cases, they're able to negotiate some of those dollars to be used for operating expenses for administrative purposes. There's 638 monies. So any given year, those external dollars will vary. Then you have the state monies. State monies as it relates to capital projects, state of New Mexico, through the state legislators will provide dollars, primarily for, again, capital improvement projects. So those dollars come across from the state. New Mexico is one state, is the state that supplies most of those types of dollars. Arizona, very, very little. Utah, not even on the map in some cases. Now, that's general fund dollars. Okay? Now, those set-aside dollars go into, again, like I indicated, go into those various funds. And that's what we call a perm fund, or the master trust fund, is made up of all of those various funds. And right now, the nation's portfolio is around $1.5 billion. Has been, the last couple years has been very good to the nation. Now, the nation cannot use any of those dollars for itself. However, given the guidelines, the nation can invest those dollars to get a return on. So let's use the casinos as an example. The nation invested those dollars just as if they invested it into the stocks, any bonds outside. And so we're getting a return on those dollars as we speak. So that's those dollars. Now, the budget process starts as we speak, has started. First thing that takes place is the revenue projection. How many dollars are going to be coming in from those areas that I described? And then based on that, then the branch chiefs, it's divvied up between the three branches. About 70 to 73% goes to the executive branch. And then legislative, and then judicial branch. The branch chiefs then work within their respective branch to divvy up the dollars to the divisions, programs, etc. The oversight committees, there used to be 11. Each of the programs had an oversight committee. And they would work through that oversight committee in terms of presenting their budget. Now that it's gone from 11 down to what it is now, same thing. The only difference is that a oversight committee now has more than one, simply because we went from 11 to where we are at today. And so it goes through that process, budget hearings. After that has taken place, then those respective oversight committees report to Budget and Finance Committee. Budget and Finance Committee has hearings anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. And so we review, evaluate what a standing committee is recommending to Budget and Finance Committee. Budget and Finance Committee has the prerogative to say, we're not going to do this. We think it needs to be over here instead of the way you're presenting it to us. We obviously go back and forth, but whatever is decided upon then is what is recommended to Navajo Nation Council. So the BNF recommends a budget to all the expenditures. Council still, at the end of the day, has final authority. They may come in and say, we don't like what any of you did, including you, Budget and Finance. We're going to do it this way, right? And they can make amendments to the budget. Now, where sometimes where we want to avoid is taking from one branch and moving it to another. Amendments can be made within the branch. When you begin to cross over from one branch to another, then everybody's feathers get ruffled up. So council has been very respectful of not doing that, going from one branch to the next. So once council passes that budget, if any amendments took place, council passes, it goes over to the president for final consideration. President then has line item veto authority. So let's use, for example, the process, monies was taken from one of his branches and moved over to another, taken from here and moved over to there. And because it went through the process, he says, this is not the way it's going to be. So he line items that particular area and same with the legislative. Definitely, if council took from executive or any of the other branches and moved it over to the legislative side, and it would get line itemed, right? And mind you, there is no line item override authority from council. So in some instances, those dollars don't ever get used unless they get reallocated back to. And that's council action takes place. So it goes through that process. Now, at the end of a fiscal year, if any of the divisions within a branch has not expended their budget, those dollars lack and they go to the UUFB, Unreserved Undesignated Fund Balance. They lapse and go over there. Unless council makes an amendment or BNF makes a recommendation to carry over the amount as it applies to a particular program division. That language is contained in the resolution that council considers. So, for example, let's say a program has a is in need of a carryover of X number of dollars. That oversight committee recommends to BNF to say, we would like this program to have this amount carried over, or the balance remaining that is carried over into the next fiscal year. If budget and finance acknowledges that recommendation, that's what goes in. So each one, each carryover that is recommended comes with the line item, the object code, the account number, all of that information. And that's what, the president considers as he's reviewing the final document. Mm-hmm. So those dollars are carried over at the end. And again, if there's no carryover, any unexpended dollars going to the UUFB, they lapse. And then those dollars become available for supplementals. And any delegate can say, I want X number of dollars for this purpose. The president himself can say, I would like this amount of dollars. But mind you, if he does that, he has to go to a delegate and say, Delegate A, I would like you to sponsor legislation to get this amount of dollars for this purpose. And so...
Hey, Samantha, if you can give me somewhere where we can have about a 5 to 10 minute break, let me know. I've got one other feature that I need to do. So go ahead and continue.
Okay, so that's the process. Now, on the external dollar side, on the external dollars, Congress appropriates dollars. It filters down through the process. Navajo gets it. There's a great number of programs that have 638 contracts through the federal government. Get those dollars. Within an award, there is a start period and an ending period. And so a program first applies for dollars. It goes through the process. It does its scope of work. It does all of what needs to be done for that request to be considered. If those dollars are awarded, then there's the scope of work has to be followed through the entire contract period. If a program fails to spend all of its dollars within that time given, the program is responsible to say, go back and say, we need this contract extended for this period of time. And so there's back and forth. In the event they're denied, then those dollars will revert back. Okay. If within that contract period they didn't follow the rules of how those dollars are to be expended, federal government can come back and say, Program A, you didn't spend the dollars like you told us you were going to spend the dollars. As such, you need to pay us back this amount. Right? That same thought applies to monies coming from the state. A project list, a chapter says we need this amount of money for waterline extension. Those dollars are awarded to the nation and for that purpose. And again, same process. You need to spend it by this period. If you don't, we need to sit down and talk about it. Now, some chapters have worked with the state, so the dollars come directly to a chapter by bypassing the Navajo Nation process. There are several chapters that have done that and have been very successful. And what it does, it just takes out the bureaucracy of the central government. So those are the dollars. That's the PERM fund, Master Trust Fund, and how all that works. If you want to take a 10-minute break, I'm good.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. That is Mr. Lorenzo Bates from the Budget and Finance, and he is also the pro temp speaker for the Navajo Nation. And this evening, we're talking about the Navajo Nation Special Prosecutor and their role, and also the Navajo Nation finances. So we're going to open up the line after this break, and we'll actually give a few more minutes for Mr. Bates to actually give us the final demonstration. I've got some questions myself. So please call in, and the telephone number here is 347-989-0048. And so right now we have our famous relative from the Navajo Nation who is comes and joins us, and he usually gives us his weekly update, Navajo Nation, or Politics on Navajo Nation Newsflash, Mr. Bill Donovan.
Cal, political activity for the tribal presidency is picking up, but as of Wednesday, only four candidates have actually filed for the post and have been certified by the Navajo Nation Board of Election Supervisors. Those who have been certified as candidates for tribal president by the election board have been Joe Shirley Jr. and Myron McLaughlin, both from Chinle, Donald Benally from Shiprock, and Kenneth Maryboy from Mexican Water. Several other prospective candidates have either picked up papers or announced their intention of being a candidate. Those who have picked up papers have been Irvin Chavez from Naskizzi, Orle Deniclaw Benally from Sheep Springs, Daniel E. Smith Sr. from Shiprock, Edison Begay from Tohatchee, and Christopher Deschini and Dale Edison Sosi, both from Machi. Begay is apparently keeping his options open since he also picked up papers to run for Navajo Nation Council as well. Russell Begay, the current council delegate from Shiprock, and Dwayne Chile Yazzie, a past council delegate from Shiprock, have also announced in the past week their plans to run for president. The interesting thing about all this is the number of candidates who are thinking of running for president from Shiprock, the biggest community on the Navajo Reservation. People from Shiprock have dreamed for decades of having one of their own run the tribe, but having four from there will probably mean that it won't be this year. Shiprock is probably the biggest political community on the Navajo Reservation. In past elections, it boasted of having the biggest percentage of voters in tribal elections, better than 70% of those who were registered. Because of this, Donald Benally almost came in second in the primary 4 years ago. He had hoped to use his voting block to challenge Ben Shelley for a spot on this year's general election ballot. But with four Shiprock residents on the primary ballot, three of whom have welded political power within the community, Donald Benally won't be able to rely on this base as much as he did 4 years ago. The big winner of all this is Shelley, who will find his way to the general election ballot to be a lot easier if all four of the Shiprock residents actually do file and run in the primary. This is Bill Donovan with a newsflash from the Navajo Reservation.
You're listening to Navajo Digital Radio, politics on the Navajo Nation. The radio show that's raising standards of Navajo intellect. A real paradigm shift. No double talk, no fool. Operating Navajo Graphic Design and Advertising Agency, CalNez Design.
You're listening to Politics on Navajo Nation. My name is Cal Nez. So I guess technically, Shashayaho Lieda, right underneath the beautiful mountain there in New Mexico. This evening, we are talking about the Navajo Nation finances. And we have Honorable Council Delegate Lorenzo Bates with us. And he is also the chairman for the Budget and Finance, and also he is the pro temp speaker for the Navajo Nation Council. So we're going to open up the lines, and for those who have questions, certainly you're welcome to call in and talk about, share your opinions, and make sure, please, so we can get more callers in, make your questions short, and as well as your comments. And so now the reason why that I would like to talk about the budget is that in all cases, you can look at the Navajo Nation government as a government. Well, certainly it is a government. But whether it's a government or a small business or a large corporation, it has to have some revenues in order to operate. And so you've got to take how much you can budget and how much is going to be for that, this. And so the monies that are coming in, as Mr. Bates has outlined for us, I think that one of the things that is that it's bottom line, it's a huge monstrous budget, $1.5 billion, and you've got operating budgets, and so it's probably going to take us about a week, almost every 2 hours, every night, to be able to cover everything here. But just in layman's term, we have a budget. And one thing that I'm curious on, Mr. Bates, is that I am looking at there's a whole document, about 17 pages, that was sent to me from the Navajo Nation Controller's Office, and it gives the breakdown of how much the executive branch is getting, how much the legislative branch gets, judicial branch, fixed costs, capital improvements, and then it breaks down Exhibit B. It breaks down the Navajo Nation Council, what their budget is, the Navajo Nation General Fund, Indirect Cost Fund, and it gives the total and the Office of the Speaker, how much that is, Government Development, Legislative, and the list goes on and on. But I think here's one of the questions that I have. Okay, we know that monies are coming in. You described it as external funds that are either grants or awards, 638s. How much specifically do we get from the Navajo Nation-owned enterprises? And how much does the casino generate? I'm just curious. And what happens to those monies? I think you said that it goes back into the general funds, and there's also another part that says permanent trust fund. So, Mr. Bates, can you enlighten us on that? Oh, hello. I guess he's dropped off for a bit, but I'll bring him back. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, you heard my question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I heard your question. The revenue projection that I mentioned, the enterprises do not contribute to the general fund, all right? Do not contribute. NAPI, NECA, NQA, they are businesses, but referred to as enterprises, owned by the Navajo Nation. So any dollars that they generate stay within company. Now, several of the enterprises contribute not to the general fund. They contribute in the form of scholarships. NECA is one, and NAPI has done that. I don't believe NQA has done it, but I know NECA annually, they contribute dollars to specifically for scholarships. But as far as dollars they generate themselves, it doesn't come to the general fund, right? The casino, an enterprise of the Navajo Nation, the dollars that they return is in the form of the debt service that they owe the Navajo Nation. Remember I talked about the permit fund, how we invested. They pay principal and interest back to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a profit from gaming enterprise, they give that amount, whatever that amount is, after expenses, back to the nation. Last year, they gave back $6 million back to the nation.
Is that a combined?
Yeah, just all from all gaming, from all the casinos that were operational. $6 million, man, after expenses. The nation, then through the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the nation's own revenue distribution plan, can expend those dollars within several categories, as long as it's within several categories. Infrastructure, economic development, programs within the government, et cetera. Now, so that's $6 million, and that money is still subject to set-asides. So $6 million came in, set-asides were taken out, and the net is what is available. Now, if gaming does not generate a profit, then obviously no money comes across too. But it's important to recognize the fact that they're obligated to pay back the nation for the loan that was given to them. Okay?
Now, okay, so just so that I'm understanding, I'm just like one of the people out there trying to understand this whole process. So how much is the enterprises, like the other enterprises besides the gaming, how much are they bringing back to the tribe?
Again, Cal, they don't they're not part of the revenue projection, right? None of their dollars that they generate come back to the tribe, to the nation. They keep that money within themselves, NAPI, NTUA, right? So if any of those enterprises are profitable, they use it to better themselves. They invest those dollars into themselves, but none of it comes over. It's not part of the revenue.
That's very interesting. Why do you suppose? Let me. I'm glad that you bring that up, because here's one of the questions that I have, and that is that, okay, you know, so technically, as the businesses that are set up up there, all the enterprises, NAPI, Navajo, you named them, NECA, I think KTNN, Navajo Arts and Crafts, Navajo Times. So they're technically the business, they got started using the Navajo tribal funds. But you're saying that they're basically independent. So the monies that are there, they generate their own fund, and they basically are pretty much self-contained. So, you know, which is great, and we hope that they do well and they continue to go and move forward. However, in the context of the other businesses that are out there, if those companies are pretty much self-contained, doesn't it appear that only the employment or the associates of that particular enterprise are the one that are the only beneficiary of the funds that's being generated, that the original money that was invested in that ultimately was seed money coming from the Navajo Nation government? So if they want to be self-employed, I mean, if they want to be independent and self-sufficient, wouldn't you think that they should be privately owned as opposed to being an enterprise of the Navajo Nation government? You know, how does that work?
Let's look at it from a resource standpoint, right? Let's use NAPI. NAPI has X number of acre feet of water that it has been allocated to develop the farm. If those waters are not used to farm the fields, those waters would flow down San Juan all the way down, and they would be used in the Phoenix area. So the nation is obligated to use those dollars. And so it generates the jobs, it grows produce, and some of that produce, it goes back to the Navajo Nation, to the ranchers, to the chapters. So rather than buying hay from Colorado, Phoenix area, they can come to NAPI, one example. NQA, electricity. If it was an outside, how would the Navajo Nation be able to develop its infrastructure? You need a company. So NQA develops that infrastructure to be able to provide power. NECA need roads. It builds the roads. Navajo Nation, Navajo Arts and Crafts, our artists that come out, our jewelers, sell their jewelry. Take it to Gallup, take it someplace else, but they have another option. Take it to and sell it to Arts and Crafts. Navajo Oil and Gas,
same situation. So, in answer to your question, could a private company and some of the enterprises would probably like to be. Right now, they are at arm's length, but they're still part of the Navajo Nation government in terms of being an enterprise. If they chose to be independent, would the nation begin to tax them? Right. Possibly. And be able to, and by doing so, then they could contribute to the revenue projection year in and year out. But now as enterprises, they benefit from not having to, other than construction and sales taxes that they would have to pay, go back to the tribe.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that, I mean, I just, you know, I don't want to belabor the concept of the enterprises, but, you know, I've got my own opinions on that. But, you know, here's the thing is that in all business, the ultimate objective is to make money. And if those monies, if the Navajo Nation or any government puts up a seed money to start a business, the objective is for that company to begin bringing back some revenues back in so that there's a benefit. And then that could be distributed amongst, you know, however that's going to work, but not so much about but it's the concept of profits. And so if they're excluded from the having to require, you know, that they should bring a revenue in, you know, it's quite an interesting setup. So now on to the other, the gaming industry. So you said about $6 million. Was that pretty much in about where you thought you guys might be at this point? And has the loans been paid back? And how does that $6 million apply to the loans? And how does the future look for the growth? I'm sure you've gotten reports from the each or one of the casinos.
The $6 million again is after all expenses. That $6 million does not service the debt because they're already making payments, quarterly payments back to the Navajo Nation. The $6 million is just profit. Now, when the nation decided to get into gaming, it was already behind the game because other tribes had, within the state of New Mexico, had already developed their gaming business and were moving ahead. So when the nation again decided, and the term that is used is called greenfield. When they decided, we decided to build a casino, and being new to the entire game, gaming enterprise would have had to go and get a loan outside, and getting that loan would have required the Navajo Nation to put up some sort of collateral in the event the gaming enterprise defaulted on their loan. So given the fact that the nation could invest, is why we did what we did. We invested into Fire Rock. That was the first one. And with any other outside arrangement, there were terms and conditions. You have to do this, you have to do that, you pay this much, this is the interest, this is the principal, et cetera. you'll make these payments quarterly. And Fire Rock outdid its projection, because a lot of the, and the reason it did was the customer base that is there now were going up the road to Dancing Eagle, all up and down, up towards Albuquerque, I-40. Those patrons came over to Navajo, onto, back into Fire Rock. So it did better than expected. Northern Edge had to compete, was competing with a casino 10 minutes outside. So it, the clientele at Northern Edge is different than Fire Rock. Navajos, Hispanics, Anglos, and Asians, as compared to Fire Rock. Flowing Water, that's at Akan or Hogback outside of Shiprock. Now that facility is a class two. Northern Edge and Fire Rock are class threes, similar to Vegas, are game slot machines. The one at Sedalcon is a smaller version. It doesn't have card games, so it's a class, the class two facility. And being a class two does not, is not generating as much as the two class two, class three facilities. So here comes Twin Arrows Casino Resort. That is the most expensive facility we have, upwards of $200 million. Again, the customer base is different from Fire Rock. It's different than Northern Edge, different than Flowing Water. It was designed to be a casino resort to bring people out, off of the interstate, out from Phoenix, up this way. So as we speak, each of the casinos have gone through, and some are still going through, a maturing period. The one that's still maturing, obviously, is Twin Arrows. And it's doing what it needs to be doing to become profitable. It's not run the same way Fire Rock is. It's not being run the same way Northern Edge is or Flowing Water. Each of the casinos takes into consideration the surrounding area and how do you get those people come in. Game. So each one is different. Bingo. Bingo's a big thing in Toyoak. Will that work at Northern Edge? Or will it work better at Flowing Water? And so those are the things that take into that are being considered. Right now, neither one has bingo. So we have Navajos that travel all the way from Chinle to play bingo at Toyoak. Can we get those same people to come to, those same folks come to Flowing Water? Or even can we get them to come to Northern Edge? Right. So those are just examples of considerations on how they do.
Wow. Well, so now, so they are, there's different classification, there's marketing needs, there's customer base, there's revenue flows, there's expenses, and all of that. And I hope that, you know, the casinos, I think one of the very interesting thing why that people really, really jumped on board with this, I mean, I'm just kind of talking in general terms, and that is that the Navajo Nation, you know, rightfully so, you know, is trying to create more revenues or more jobs and have some kick, not, I don't mean to use the word kickback, but more revenues, you know, to make a profit so that it'll be beneficial to the Navajo people. Now, how is, you know, and that's the reason why that I think that most of the questions, most of the discussion out there in the community has been people saying, how is the casino revenues, how is that going to benefit us now that we've all, quote, approved it, we jumped on board, we've allowed these casinos to happen? Is it, are any of these monies ever going to touch somewhere down the road? Let's say we basically, these become profitable and we make billions and trillions of dollars. And how is this going to benefit the Navajo people?
Well, the gaming enterprise first obligation is to pay back the nation for the loan that was given to them. That's their, they have to do that, and that's what they're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
Once they've paid back the loan, those dollars that would have otherwise been gone, that would have otherwise gone back to the nation to service the debt, now could become the profit. And that's how it's projected. So after this payback loan, those dollars through the Navajo Nation, through the Navajo statute of the revenue distribution, those dollars come back to the nation. Now, it's not say that gaming says we want to do this, we want to expand, we want to make Fire Rock a permanent facility, or we want to build a hotel. Navajo Nation, we've paid you back, can you loan us more money, or we can use these other dollars. So those are, that's a possibility. But again, to the revenue distribution plan, profits of gaming come over. And so they'll grow. And then those dollars could be used for those categories that I mentioned earlier. And that's what is being done today with that $6 million, is how to get those dollars back to the nation. How can they be expended? But mind you, there, the expenditure requirements, rules, are guided by the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act.
So it will never, it will, none of these funds will ever get into the private citizen to assist them in any way, what form?
Well, and that's where we're, that's where we are at today. Because when you look at the, when you look at the requirements and how the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act structured, it accommodates a smaller tribe. Yeah. But when you look at the size of Navajo, the size of, how do you get those requirements to apply to, way, to the way Navajo is? And as we speak, those, that question and several others are on the desk of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act to say, look, this we cannot, we're not able to do this based on your requirements, and we've outlined it. So we're awaiting a response back. If they recognize the nation as being unique in its own way, then possibly it can help an elder, it can help a student that needs scholarship money, etc. But mind you, we're not on a per capita. And so that issue is being addressed today.
So the realities, so the realities of this going into this thing is that, well, the whole concept, whether the revenue flow of it from a casino could benefit a small tribe, but knowing that the Navajo Nation was such a huge, you know, population as well as land base, there was really no feasible way of making the dollars flow to as it would for a smaller tribe. So knowing that, what was the real purpose of really going into this thing if they approved it?
Well, you know, because nobody can say, been there, done that, Navajo. This is the way you've done it. You're going to do it. We're there now. Gaming Enterprise has made a profit. They've contributed $6 million back. Now, how do we do this? On the surface, it looked like, hey, it can be done. But when you begin to look at the legalities surrounding the statute, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, it showed, well, let's step back here to make sure. But mind you, gaming is very highly regulated. So to ensure that in the future years, as gaming becomes profitable, we now can say, been there, done that, we've done our research, and this is how we're going to do it. So we are taking those small steps to ensure that we don't jeopardize these dollars.
Yeah. Mr. Bates, would you mind taking some calls? We got a couple of callers. Once I bring you on, please be ready with your question. Make them short. We only have 12 minutes, and there's a lot of things that I appreciate, you know, for Honorable Bates to be here with us this evening to share, you know, his information. I'm sure that he'll come back sometimes here real soon, because, you know, we're just barely, we're not even scraping the surface on this thing. This is so, so huge, and I'm sure that a lot of you have any questions and such like that. So, Yat A caller, you are on the air, 4998. Can you hear me?
Hi, Cal?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yes.
This is actually Arizona State Representative James T. Sapeshwakai. And I actually don't have a question for Shanella, Mr. Bates, So I just wanted to give a legislative update from the state of Arizona. And then also I am listening in on the show, and I do appreciate all the knowledge and the information that Shanella, Honorable Council Delegate Bates, is giving to your listeners.
Okay. Yeah, why don't you give us a real quick update? Thank you so much for calling in, by the way.
Okay. I'm actually on the interstate on the freeway in Phoenix, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull over because I wasn't quite sure that you're going to get to me.
Okay.
So, but, in the state legislature, I was on the floor all day today. We got into onto the floor doing committee of the whole and third readings all day. We just got off the floor right before 5 p.m. And the word at the legislature right now is that we will be finishing up with the 2014 session, most likely.
Hello? Uh-oh. Look, I don't know what happened there. I guess we lost her. Hello, we got a caller here. 7612. Make it quick. We only got about 9 minutes. We still got Marty to bring in. Hello, caller. Okay, I guess they're not listening in. So, just in conclusion, Shananta, could you just kind of give us a wrap-up, and we'll go ahead and finish this up. And but again, would you be able to come back here sometimes in the future to continue this discussion?
Don't press it, Cal.
Oh, I appreciate you being here. I do. I really do. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll, you know, if there's a subject that you need me to, and nobody else will talk on, yeah, I'll give it a shot. But to wrap up, one of the things, the nation has never operated in deficit. Okay. Our revenue projections have been on. We've never put the nation in operated in the red. So it is a very long, tedious process to be able to go back to the Navajo Nation Council and to the people to say, this is our revenue projection. We can take care of you. Right? I've been on budget and finance for 2 terms. And in each case, we've been able to come out with the exception of 1 year where the oil prices, if you recall, were running at $100 a barrel, and it went down to 30. Okay. That has been the only year that we had to come up with an alternative way so that the nation wouldn't operate in the red, and it paid off. But since then, the nation's portfolio is in good shape. Of course, we're subject to the market up and down. And if you recall, in 2008, we took a $300 million hit, but we rebound to where we are at. At some point in time, people are going to have to decide, do we want to draw down the principal? And the people are required to vote on that. You got $1.5 billion there. Pull down an amount to power line extensions, water line development, capital improvement projects throughout Navajo. At some point, the nation is going to have to decide to use that, to consider using those dollars in one way or another. Thank you, Cal. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. That was pro temp speaker, Mr. Lorenzo Bates, and he is also the budget and finance engineer. And I know that not too many people get this opportunity, but thank you for, on behalf of the listeners, that you're able to provide this with us. And you have a wonderful evening.
Okay, thank you.
Well, yes, there you have it. That was and that's incredible that he's able to give us that opportunity. And listeners, you're out there. Here's your opportunity to call in and to ask the questions and the concern that I keep seeing being cycled on Facebook. And so just in closing, at least for my portion, I just want to say, and all, again, there's monies, there's revenues, there's, and we need to be looking at this thing, and everybody who is involved, from all the way from the president's office to the tribal government, and they've got to be there to be able to look at these businesses and know and have some background knowledge to be able to make these things work. And it's quite impressive. It's a huge monster budget. At some point, yes, we're making these monies, but there's enterprises. What are they doing with their money? And it's quite interesting that now that the concept, the perception why that I think most people jump on board chapters is that we approve these casinos and all of a sudden we're realizing that we can't touch it, or at least not at this point. So having said that, I'll talk to you guys next week. And the rest of the time, which is about 4 minutes and 5 seconds, Marley Shabala, you have the floor.
Thank you, Cal. And first off, when you were talking to Mr. Bates about the enterprises and whether or not they would contribute any of their revenues back to the general fund, that's a really interesting question, because if they paid taxes, they would contribute back. And I think that as small business people here on the Navajo Reservation, we're obligated to pay taxes. But these huge enterprises, which are owned by the tribal government, are not obligated to pay these taxes. And the most recent one is, you know, the Navajo Transitional Energy Company, which received a huge amount of, if they paid their taxes, I think that they might, the tribe would be receiving like $6 million a month anyway. And that's what, you know, the casinos are generating in 1 year. And Twin Arrows, on the council floor, I have heard from the council delegates that it's losing money. So perhaps that $6 million would be a lot larger if the other casinos weren't, you know, dragging it out of debt. And as far as the issue concerning the permanent trust fund, and that, you know, it should be opened up so it's going to help us with our water lines and our electrical lines and everything else, the council cannot even decide on a capital improvement project. They start arguing over what communities should have those water lines, what communities should have a new government building, and everything is frozen. And the capital improvement project legislation is going to the council next week. The council's in session, so I urge all of the listeners to see if they can't tune in to Navajo Broadcast Services with Streams It Live, or tune in to my blog, Marley Shabala's Notebook, and I'll be reporting on the spot from the Navajo Nation Council chambers in Window Rock about what is happening with our council. And another issue that I that Mr. Bates also touched on was that there were they had never operated in a deficit. Well, maybe not the tribal government as a whole when they did their annual budget, but they did go into a deficit. The Council of 88 overspent $25 million. And so when the Peabody, the settlement of a lawsuit that the Navajo Nation had filed against Peabody for going behind their backs and keeping the coal royalties low, when that was settled, there was over a $50 million settlement. But $25 million went to pay off that debt that was created by the Council of 88. So anyway, I'm just quickly going through a lot of the issues, and hopefully I won't get kicked out of the council for my statement. Just kidding. Anyway, thanks to all the listeners out there, and thank you, Cal, for this great opportunity for the people to hear from their tribal elected officials. Hakoore.
You're listening to Navajo Digital Radio, politics on the Navajo Nation. The radio show that's raising standards of Navajo intellect. A real paradigm shift. No double talk, no fool.
Thank you. World Voice on Navajo Politics, brought to you by the longest operating Navajo graphic design and advertising agency, CalNez Designs.